connected to that. In this hour, I'm going to be speaking to the CEO of the Gender-Based Violence and Femicide Response Fund, Lindi Dlamini. She's already on standby. Just to get a sense of how the fund is doing, I think recently a report was tabled as to the work of the fund and exactly what the work of the fund is, what was it inspired by, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion. Very important in the fight against gender-based violence in this country. I think the president at some point called it the second epidemic. And joining me now is Lindi Dlamini. She's CEO and a CEO at GBVF Fund, which is the Gender-Based Violence and Femicide Response Fund. She joins me now on the line. Lindi, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Good evening, Aubrey, and good evening to the listeners. Thank you for having me.
So what is the Gender-Based Violence and Femicide Response Fund, Lindi?
The Gender-Based Violence and Femicide Response Fund is a fund that was launched in the history of the fight against gender-based violence and femicide in this country. You will remember that the civil society activists under the banner Total Shutdown Movement militated, marched on the streets, marched to the JSE, but more importantly, marched on our streets, really making all sectors of our society aware of the pernicious and pervasive and increasing levels of gender-based violence and femicide.
Yeah.
And this culminated in the presidential summit that took place in 2018, which then led to the drafting of the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence, a document which is really the strategic blueprint for gender-based violence and femicide. It is multifactorial, which means it includes everybody, corporate, government, private sector, etc. And so it was then that early last year, one of the things that's supposed to be done to implement the National Strategic Plan is the setup of a council and a fund by the government. And given the fact that we implement our lawmaking processes are democratized, they sometimes take longer than we would like. The International Women's Forum of South Africa then asked the president how they can support, and this is how the fund was born, with a number of corporates supporting it as part of a response to the call by the president to pledge funds towards the fund. And so it was that this fund was launched on the 4th of February of 2021.
What does the fund do?
The fund's primary responsibility is to raise funds and deploy funds to community-based organizations that are at the grassroots of fighting the scourge of gender-based violence within communities. And of course, the focus is on high-impact community-based organizations because they already have the trust of their communities. They have already been doing work in the communities. And this is an acknowledgement, really, of the fact that these organizations have been working overburdened, underfunded in our communities, trying to make a difference. And the fund's primary responsibility is to make sure that those CDOs are able to do the work that they are currently doing. We also have a mandate and responsibility to ensure that funding is equitably distributed across all the province, that funding reaches the poorest of the poor, the marginalized in rural areas, informal settlements, and the like, but also to make sure that CDOs that are not yet in a position to apply for funding in their own right are supported through project management, capacity building, et cetera. And that is the role of the four large intermediary organizations that we have brought on board.
How much money does the fund have at the moment?
The fund currently has raised 165 million, committed 69 million rand to these organizations over a two-year period as part of the funding approval of the board late last year.
And where's the money coming from?
The money has predominantly come from South African corporates, but we've also had support from social development partners such as the British High Commission, as well as the philanthropic, professional philanthropic organizations such as the Ford Foundation and the Gates Foundation, But South African corporates have really risen to the challenge and showed up for their compatriots in a demonstration of the fact that they are just as invested in fighting the scourge.
I imagine it's not enough, though, Lindy, as you said to me, that the frequency of the scourge is ever increasing. We have campaigns, we have months such as August, where we really focus on that. It's not just Women's Month, but it's Women's Month because we focus on issues around gender-based violence. We have the conversations here on this platform. But as you said, the frequency of it just is staggeringly high and increasing. Somebody might come back to you, Lindy, and say, but then why does the GBVF fund exist if we are not seeing a decrease of the scourge?
It's nowhere near enough. And the funds must exist because, remember, the primary institution that is responsible for providing this protection, for prevention, and for executing all of the strategies across all the pillars is the government itself. We don't receive government funding, and the fund is really private sector saying we will show up and do what we can until such time as the GBVF Council has been set up in terms of the bill that is currently going through lawmaking processes. And so although it's nowhere near enough, there's a lot of work that's happening and that's being done, and we intend to amplify and accelerate this work. It is important. In this space, one learns, Aubrey, that every rand makes a difference. The other part of what we do that I didn't speak about as a convener is to ensure that the messages around this are spread. And to this extent, we engage with a number of organizations, corporates and so forth, really conscientizing them around the pernicious scourge and what they can do. But we also set up seminars, webinars on some of the causalities and how these can be overcome by society. So there's a whole lot of work beyond resourcing and raising funds. There's a whole lot of work that the fund occasions, including enrolling and enlisting forensic scientists and pathologists to take a look at what we can do around the DNA processing and improve the DNA processing levels, which of course are a reason why we see a lot of victims not seeing justice as they expect to, and the consequent erosion of the social contract between the states and those victims.
Give me an example of a CBO in a specific community that you've assisted that didn't have the capacity. For example, that more mature, more established CBO has that you funded. I'm trying to get a sense of what sort of CBO and what sort of work would they be doing in a particular community. Just give me a sense, Lindy.
So, Aubrey, let me start off by saying that in focusing our approach, 40% of our funding has gone to rural areas and 20% to informal settlements. But if I were to give you an example, and a very good one at that, of an entity that did exist but has been able to achieve scale in its activities, particularly given the legislative amendments that were assented to by the president as part of the fight against gender-based violence and femicide in February, Lawyers Against Violence is a good example. They are in Berea, they are in Orange Farm, and they are in Deep Sluit, and really helping women to get protection orders and so forth. And the new legislation really helps them to do that more efficiently and more effectively. There are also a host of organizations within rural areas, Eastern Cape, KZN, Limpopo, who previously did not have access to sufficient funding. They did have some funding because, of course, one of our requirements was that they must have been doing this work for at least a year because the fund itself was new, so we couldn't all be new to the space. We needed some kind of track record from our partners. but we have a host of organizations where we've come across as the main funder of the activities that they are running.
So the reason why I ask that question is sometimes, I don't know, sometimes I think we make the mistake of thinking, that if we throw money at a particular situation, we'll solve the problem. And so we do everything we can to raise the money, and professional people get involved in that process. The money gets raised. Corporates want to help. I suppose the litmus question for me is, are the funds that are being given to these organizations helping in the reduction, the quelling of the scourge of gender-based violence? In other words, what I'm looking to get a sense of, Lindy, is the fund, because the fund is raising the money, the corporates are coming to the party, but is this translating in dealing with gender-based violence, or is it just a matter of funding organizations that are supposed to deal with gender-based violence, therefore creating a new industry? In other words, why would I want gender-based violence to end if it is a money spinner? I don't want to be facetious, but I don't know if you get the spirit of my question.
I totally get the spirit of your question. You know, when we launched the call last year and we were on all media, radio stations, community radio stations, that was the main question. And it is an important question because you amplify the voices of the public, and the public do want to know, is this a waste of money? Is it, yes, you're right, the creation of a new industry. But if you look at Etembeni Community Center in the Northern Cape, has got a low population but large landmass. It is difficult to get any kind of social response services to them. And we had to pick them to do this work in the space to ensure that there is a bit of reach. And if you look at an organization, for instance, such as Cincinnati Risoko Etsilibiane in Mpumalanga, it didn't previously have sufficient funding. And the important thing is that setting out, this was not money that was just thrown at people to do it as they wished. We set out measures for them. We set out targets for all of these organizations, and we set out reporting. And as we stand now, we've just received the first of the reporting from these organizations. And we work with an implementation partner called Chikululu that's been around for quite a while. And they do the work of maintaining contact with all of these organizations, getting the monthly reporting and getting it back to us. And the purpose of the reporting and the recent on-site visits, as well as monitoring and evaluation reporting, is to ensure that, number one, the funds have gone to what they were intended to do. Number two, that those organizations are not experiencing any operational impediments or any other kind of impediments to delivering on those programs. Number three, that reporting is being provided with substantive qualitative and quantitative measures, because we in turn are accountable to civil society, to the public, as well as the donors who have provided us with this funding. So we in turn have got to ensure that the entities that we work with, the funds that we, the CBOs that we work with, are indeed reporting into us. We will have a fuller reporting as part of the annual report at the end of the year. But it was incumbent on us to check in and establish that, having paid all of these organizations in record time, really, that they are going about the work and they are delivering, because we've contracted with them. So you don't just get grant funding. You get grant funding and a contract. And the contract includes the terms and conditions of the grant, which include the measures, because we want to see who is being impacted. And I'm glad to see that we've seen around 18,000 people being impacted within those small organizations that we're dealing with. 62% were women, 38% were men, and it's good to see that men are being reached by these programs. and 45% of those who have been reached are the youth, and we do want the youth to participate in these programs.
Lindi Dlamini is my guest. She's CEO of the GBVF Fund, which is the Gender-Based Violence and Femicide Response Fund. Dineko is on the line in Johannesburg South. Hi, Dineko. Your question or comment for Lindi?
Hi, Brahms. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, Dineko. What's on your mind, sir?
I'm good. How are you, Nelindi?
Go ahead, Dineko. She's listening.
I'm very well, thanks, Dineko. How are you?
No, I'm good. My question is that we are one of the organizations who applied when that call was made. We are an NGO. With the objectives of, we deal with all social ills. But then the outcome was just saying that, it was not successful. So my question is that, are you guys allowed or you're not allowed? That's where my question is, to give the reasons why the application was not successful.
Lindi?
Yes, Dineko, I am really, really sorry. I will tell you that when we first received the responses, we had upwards of 400 organizations that had applied. And it was a really, really grueling and difficult process, because we acknowledge and recognize that everybody who's doing work in this space is not doing a work to get money or whatever, but they do need to be supported. But we did also know that there's a finite amount of resources that we have to provide. And in the end, 110 organizations were successful, and these were picked based on how closely they met the requirements of the call for proposals, which was really aimed at ensuring that there's enough rural participation, equitable distribution of funds across province, a focus on the GBVF hotspots, which, as you know, we didn't just stick to the SAPS 30. We also got an additional 15 by way of incidents from researchers and academics that we worked with. And so the competition was tight, Dineko, my brother. So I'm hoping that next year we'll be able to release another call for proposals. We really want to amplify and accelerate the impact of your work. And I wish you every success. And not getting funding in this round does not mean the work you're doing is not valuable. So please keep at it.
I want to read you these questions, and they're very closely related to the question that I asked before Dineko came on, Lindi. This person says, Aubrey, it really baffles me as to how money, no matter how much, will alleviate or deal with the scourge of GBV. Can your guest explain how, for example, a protection order will stop a sick boyfriend, a husband, from abusing and even maybe killing his girlfriend? And perhaps closely related to that, Tonic on Twitter says, Aubrey, please could you ask our guest what causes GBV and how can we stop it? And I suppose it's all connected to the question that I asked earlier on. Are we trying to stop GBV or are we trying to manage it?
We're trying to stop it, but it's not going to be easy. If you look at the National Strategic Plan, it's really intended as a 10-year program. When we go to the causes, and by the way, we don't believe money is the cure to all ills. And that's why I said earlier on, our programs are not just funding, although we acknowledge how important it is that entities such as the one that Dineko was talking about, who have been doing work in this space, do have to be resourced. There are people who get up and provide programs, interventions, training, and so forth to communities. That's how they spend their time. They don't see it as a job. But when they are there, they do need the support to do that. Otherwise, they let go and find a job that pays. So we don't see this as an industry, but we value the individuals that are contributing towards this fight by doing what they can within their communities. So that's one. But secondly, I've mentioned that the fund is not just an accelerator of that work, but also a convener. So the majority of the work that we do outside of calls for proposals is around how we partner with other parties playing a role in the space. And so an example of that is the National Strategic Plan, or NSP Collaborative, which is a multi-sectoral collaborative of all entities, NPOs, NGOs, civil community-based organizations, NPOs, as well as some participants from government who are doing work across the six pillars of the National Strategic Plan. The causes of gender-based violence are largely rooted in our patriarchal culture that really talks to, if you look at Pillar 2, for instance, which talks to prevention and social cohesion, what we are tackling there is dealing with toxic masculinity stereotypes and stereotypes that lead people to stereotype what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man, and define those in a position of subservience one to the other, and the idea that gender is binary. Gender is not binary. There are various forms of expressions of gender. We need to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And the more we know about that, the more educated we are about that, the less we otherize people, and the less you see harm. So we're dealing with unlearning, which is not a one-year situation, societal unlearning and rebuilding social cohesion. And that's not a one-year process, or even a five-year process, I would argue.
What's your relationship with law enforcement, Lindy? And how much of a priority is gender-based violence? Is the law enforcement sector? And I know that I'm talking about a very big space here, not just the police, but that whole sector.
Yes, certainly are.
How much of a priority is gender-based violence? Because everybody says the right things, right?
Mm.
Everybody's educated and says all of the right stuff, and you know all the one-liners have been set up. Everybody knows how to speak the speak. And I suppose that's the frustration. The frustration is everybody is just doing the right thing, but this thing is growing. It's becoming cheekier. It's becoming more brazen. There's even a sense that there are those who believe that they are on a crusade to right the wrongs of wokeness, if you know what I mean. What is the attitude of law enforcement around GBV?
So I hold no brief to speak for them, but I can say what the law now requires them to do. So the Pillar 3 of the National Strategic Plan really talks to protection and safety, and it talks to creating a victim-centric justice system in which the SAPS play the role that they are supposed to play, protecting victims of gender-based violence. And the courts are supposed to be victim-centric in how those processes are run. And pursuant to the Criminal Procedure Amendment Act, Domestic Violence Amendment Act that were passed, that were assented to by the President and took effect on the 5th of August, they have all been retrained on this. Reason being, if an SAPS member doesn't do what they need to do in order to protect the rights of a survivor, a victim who is reporting an incident, this is a disciplinable offense. And that's different to before. So they can't be playing the role of mediator and so forth. It is, of course, because they are a microcosm of a society, going to be a process. But if you walk into a police station today, you are likely to see what is the sum total of quite a rollout that has been happening, specific GBV desks. Because how traumatizing is it for a victim to have to tell their story in a charge office full of people who are there for affidavits and a host of other issues? And these are some of the things that they've been trained on. When one of our partners, grant partners, Mosaic, played a role in this training. If you ask me, the problem is bigger than any one arm of society, division of society, government department, and so forth. If you look at COVID, and I accept that COVID was a global pandemic, I accept that it invoked a public health accountability that is constitutional on the part of government, But we sit today with a lot of people, and I don't know if you saw the article in the Mail and Guardian, really trying to talk to the funding allocation that had been made available for all of these areas of government to respond to this problem. And, you know, you can draw your own conclusions from that.
Yeah.
We as a society have really got to, number one, hold ourselves accountable, but hold all the powers that be accountable for having the political will and the drive to go the distance, because there's no benefit, Aubrey, of us living in a constitutional democracy that is lauded the world over. If I can't walk the streets free, my daughter can't walk the streets free, the elderly are being abused, the disabled are 8 times more likely to be abused, the LGBTQIA community is killed by members of the same society. So it's us talking about us to us and asking law enforcement to help us to maintain our social contract of Ubuntu. We really need to go back to our own values.
Yeah.
So the conversation is not just one to government, and absolutely government has a tremendous responsibility to provide leadership and accountability in keeping with Pillar 1 of the National Strategic Plan. We ourselves have got to be asking ourselves, what is the kind of society we want to live in, be part of, and drive a prosperous future in? There's an economic cost and impact to
this,
of course.
Yes, yes. Lindy, Dlamini, I have to...
It's 1% of GDP.
Yeah.
But I absolutely appreciate the opportunity to tell the story and your time in asking the questions that should be asked.
Yeah. Lindy Dlamini, thank you so much. How do people get in touch with you if indeed they want to talk to you a bit more about their projects in the various communities, as Danico did? How do people get in touch with the GBVF fund?
They can email us at info@gbvfresponsefund1.org. or go onto our website, where we will publish any further and future calls for proposals and where they can get in touch and keep in touch with what we are doing. And that's GBVFResponseFund1.org. I thank you so much for your time.
Much appreciated.
For listening.
Lindy Dlamini is CEO at the GBVF Fund. Yeah, I wonder what you think of that. I'd love to take your calls. Now, in the morning,